ConstantContact.com.
I'm Sean Canaan. This is the WMNF News on Midpoint. Every few years, the Western Hemisphere's heads of state hold a summit of the Americas. It can often be a stage for anti-U.S. rhetoric and U.S. apathy. WLRN America's editor Tim Padgett reports from Panama on why this weekend's summit was different.
This is obviously a historic meeting.
As President Obama said, what happened Saturday was indeed historic. At the summit of the Americas, Obama and Cuban leader Raul Castro sat down for a face-to-face chat. It was the first between U.S. and Cuban heads of state since 1956. In this case, it was to discuss efforts to normalize relations, which were severed in 1961. Obama received widespread applause at the Panama summit for his new Cuban engagement policy.
I think we are now in a position to move on a path towards the future and leave behind some of the circumstances of the past that have made it so difficult, I think, for our countries to communicate.
Obama warned the U.S. and Cuba still have deep differences over issues like human rights. Castro, who called Obama an honest man at the summit, also sounded conciliatory but cautious.
We are willing to discuss every issue.
But our countries have a
long and complicated history.
Obama also had a brief chat with Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. Maduro had lashed out at the U.S. for what he called its hypocritical criticism of Venezuela's human rights situation. But he received far less attention. I'm Tim Padgett in Panama.
As you heard in headlines, Senator Marco Rubio announced today he's running for president. He announced it in a call with donors. Rubio will speak at 6 this afternoon, where he'll officially announce his candidacy for the 2016 presidential race. WLRN's Diego Saldana Rojas reports, even though Senator Rubio is trying to become President Rubio, he's also held another title, Professor Rubio.
Abel Ramos Taipe was 23 years old and a few electives short of graduating with a degree in international relations from Florida International University. Upon looking for one of those final electives needed to graduate, an international relations course billed with two lecturers caught his eye.
So I saw this class taught by Marco Rubio and I just decided, yeah, why not?
That 2013 summer course had Dario Moreno billed as the other lecturer. He conducted the more traditional role of college professor by hosting office hours and conducting research. Rubio was more of a consistent guest lecturer, showing up every other day according to Taipei. He would promptly arrive and usually leave right after class, at times staying to have one-on-one conversation with students. But what surprised the then 23-year-old was the separation between senator and professor.
He was really open to critics and to other opinions and ideas that probably he wouldn't contemplate because of his party affiliation. You know, he's a Republican.
Like many other university professors, Rubio didn't pass up on chances to test his comedic skills.
He would throw sometimes jokes about policy and current events, but not that much, not that often.
I'm Diego Saldana Rojas in Miami.
Another endangered Florida panther has been struck and killed by a vehicle. Mark Lotz of the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission says the remains of the year-old female panther were collected today along a state road in Collier County. It's the 10th panther death this year caused by a collision with a vehicle and the 16th panther death overall. Florida set a record last year with 25 road kills and 33 overall deaths. Florida panthers once roamed the entire southeastern U.S., but only about 180 remain in the wild. Elsewhere in southwest Florida, authorities are adding panther crossings under some roads to keep the big cats from colliding with cars as they expand their range northward. Officials say panthers need to expand their range for the species to survive. While a citizen-led effort seeks to put a solar power expanding initiative on the 2016 ballot, a legislative proposal in Tallahassee would put more restrictions on how individuals and companies can utilize solar. Eric Barton with the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting recently wrote an article about Big Energy's control over the legislature and solar power in Florida. He spoke with WLRN's Gina Jordan about why the Sunshine State is not a leader in solar power and who's trying to quash growth in the industry.
Efforts to make the Sunshine State a leader in solar power are ramping up with a citizen-led initiative. A proposed constitutional amendment planned for the 2016 ballot would allow entities other than utility companies to sell the solar power they generate. At the same time, legislation proposed in Tallahassee would keep Florida as one of only five states that prevent anyone other than utilities from selling solar power. Eric Barton with the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting joins us. Eric, you wrote an article that paints a picture of a former state representative, Punta Gorda Republican Paige Kriegel, as a lawmaker who came to Tallahassee with hopes of growing the solar industry, but he was ostracized, and he was shocked by that. Tell us what happened.
Kriegel chaired the House Energy Committee in 2009, and he wanted to see more rooftop solar in Florida. He saw it as a way to just get government out of the way of an industry. But his idea went against the state's utility companies, and he says that made him a pariah. People saw him and walked the other way and shut doors on him as he walked through the House. The story he tells is one we heard from several politicians who challenge utilities.
Well, the bottom line is a lot of people think the Sunshine State should be a leader in solar power. So what's holding us back?
The main thing that's holding us back is a law that creates monopolies for local utility companies. And the law has a good reason for existence. Back 100 years ago, multiple power companies could try to sell you electricity, and they were multiple lines and poles all stretched around your town. So Florida law created local monopolies to avoid that. That law, however, restricts what's possible in other states, which is a solar company can come in, put panels on your roof for free, and then sell you back the electricity. It's called third-party sales, and that's illegal in Florida.
And are there other laws in Florida that have prevented the growth of solar by individuals and companies?
Yes, the main thing is that if you produce extra electricity in Florida, you get about 3 cents per kilowatt hour for all the power that you generate and put back onto the system. In other states, it's as much as 12 cents, so there's a lot less motivation for people to put in solar. Also, the state's regulatory commission that oversees utility companies recently took away the incentives to build solar, and that was at the request of the utility companies.
So you mentioned a proposal that would prevent homeowners from selling the extra energy they create from solar back to the utility companies. What or who is behind that proposal?
There's a group called ALEC, or the American Legislative Exchange Council, that writes model legislation that gets passed around in every state capital. They've written legislation that would end net metering, or the ability to sell extra power back to the power companies from your solar system. Right now, it's being passed around Tallahassee, and there's a lot of people who say it's going to probably be tacked onto another bill. ALEC, by the way, is funded by the Koch brothers and a lot of oil money, and so they have an incentive in making sure solar doesn't grow in Florida.
Your article talks about the influence of financial contributions from utility companies to political parties and candidates. If we're taking a politician's view, I guess, you know, where do the utilities rank among their biggest supporters?
We looked at utility companies and found that they have donated about $12 million since 2010 to state politicians. That makes them among the most influential there. There are states out there that restrict utility companies in the way that they donate money. This is certainly an example of how you can use money to influence politics.
Well, let's get down to it then. I'm going to ask you to spell it out. What's really behind the campaign by utility companies to keep rooftop solar from expanding?
Critics of the utility companies will say it's all about greed, that every kilowatt that you produce from your solar system is a kilowatt they can't sell you. But they do have a legitimate concern. If everyone put solar on their roofs tomorrow, it would cause a huge disruption to the system. All of a sudden, we wouldn't need all these power plants. We wouldn't need all the power lines and poles. But on really cloudy days or at night, all of a sudden, we'd need all of that to ramp up. It is likely inevitable that a lot of us are going to put solar on our roofs. The solar companies say it's an efficient system and you can lower your costs over long term. So I think the utility companies are starting to realize that solar will become a big industry in Florida. Whether that's next year or in 10 years, it all depends on Tallahassee.
All right. Eric Barton with the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Gina.
I'm Gina Jordan.
More Florida students are passing advanced placement exams than nearly every other state in the country. WLRN's John O'Connor reports it also means Florida students have an advantage entering college.
3 in 10 students who graduated in Florida last year passed at least one college-level AP exam. That's the highest percentage in state history and third best in the country, behind Maryland and Connecticut. For years, Florida has pushed more students to take AP exams as a way to prepare graduates for college. It can also save them money. Many colleges offer credits to students who score 3 or better on the 5-point scale. Last year, 57% of Florida seniors had taken at least one AP exam. But even with more students passing the exam, minority and low-income students still trail their classmates. Black and low-income students are less likely than their peers to take an AP exam, And while Hispanic students are just as likely to take an AP exam, they are less likely to pass an exam. I'm John O'Connor in Miami.
Here's the Tampa Bay area weather this afternoon: partly cloudy and breezy. There'll be a chance of thunderstorms, especially inland. Highs will be in the high 80s. Tonight, expect partly cloudy skies with a chance of showers or thunderstorms. Lows will be in the low 70s. And tomorrow, partly cloudy with a chance of a stray shower or thunderstorm. Highs will be in the low 90s. This has been the WMNF News segment of Midpoint. Thanks to our engineer, Charlie Cushing. I'm Sean Canan. After this short music break, we'll take your calls about the five-year anniversary of the BP oil disaster. We'll have a guest from the USF Marine Science College, and we're also hoping that U.S. Congressmember Kathy Castor will join us. Stay with us. Welcome to Midpoint. 5 years ago this month, the Deepwater Horizon oil rig exploded in the Gulf of Mexico. We'd like to hear what you think about the disaster and the aftermath and what questions remain. Give us a call at 813-239-9663. You'll also be more likely to get on the air if you call now than if you wait until the end of the show. You can also email us at dj@wmnf.org. You can text us at 813-433-0885. In a few minutes, we'll be speaking to a professor of marine science at the USF College of Marine Science in St. Petersburg. But first, I want to play a story, that an interview that I did with someone from BP 5 years ago. So this is from May of 2010. It was a few weeks after the blowout. The BP had said at the time that the ongoing leak had cost the company $350 million so far, but now it's in the billions of dollars. And crude oil was washing up on the shores and marshes of Louisiana as I did this interview. And the Deepwater Horizon well was continuing to gush out of control. And then BP sent someone from what's called the Unified Command in St. Petersburg. It was estimating the amount of oil coming from the leak at 5,000 barrels per day, even though BP executives told Congress a week earlier that they did not know the rate of the leak and that it could be up to 60,000 barrels a day. So in May of 2010, a few weeks after the blowout, I spoke with Keith Seon. He's the incident commander for BP the incident commander for BP at the St. Petersburg Unified Command Center, and we spoke about their preparations for oil on the coast of West Florida.
So I'm here, so there isn't an incident, but there is the possibility. So I'm here to work on BP's behalf with the Unified Command, the U.S. Coast Guard, and the Department of Environmental Protection of Florida to prepare. So we're doing planning, we're looking at resources, we're securing whatever necessary resources we need based on the current state of the oil spill.
What's the worst case scenario that you're preparing for? Let's say the oil comes near the coast, endangering like the mangroves or the seagrasses or the coastal, the beaches. What are some things you can do to prevent that?
So many people may not be familiar. I know the emergency response organizations are, that there is an area contingency plan across the entire Gulf Coast. And that area contingency plan identifies the sensitive areas that need to be protected, and it also identifies the protective methods for that area. So what we do is we take those plans, we go through them, we ensure that they're accurate, that nothing's changed since they were developed, and work the strategies for deploying the right types of resource. And in many cases, there's a variety of things that you can do to protect the shoreline. Boom can be placed. There's also cleaning up that can be done to reduce the impact on the shore, and there are other technologies that, if necessary, can be deployed.
Does that include chemical dispersants when it's near the coast, or are they just using that out in the open Gulf?
Yeah, there's no intent to use chemical dispersants, and it's actually not permitted within a certain distance of the shore.
And booms, how well do booms protect coastlines from oil spills? Is it only in calm weather, or is it generally protective of the shoreline?
I'm not qualified to answer that question. What we do is we follow the area contingency plan, and I think with anything that is deployed, depending on the environmental conditions and the condition of the equipment, those drive the effectiveness of that protection. So we do it for a reason. We're doing it to protect the shoreline, and we're going to deploy every method we know. And the consultants that we have, both with the state agencies as well as BP, give us the best information, and hopefully we develop the right tactics to optimize that protection.
What's the partnership like between the Coast Guard, BP, and the Florida Department of Environmental Protection? Are there certain roles that each of you are responsible for?
We've been in a unified command across the Gulf Coast, and here in St. Petersburg, it's been very strong between BP, the Coast Guard, and the Department of Environmental Protection. Relationship's strong. We have been challenged by the local agencies to manage and do what we can to prepare them to protect their shoreline. So they are stern about what they want, but we do come to agreement. We have so far on what measures we can employ, and so far it's been, and I expect going forward, a very strong relationship between the all agencies that are working with BP to protect shoreline.
And my final question is, you're preparing in case there's an emergency. What does it look like? What's the forecast for potentially for the oil to reach West Central Florida?
So my expertise is not in the projection. If you look, the experts are NOAA, and NOAA has a 72-hour projection that is updated daily. And right now, the extent of the oil spill is over 300 miles away from the Tampa-St. Pete area. So we're not assuming that nothing could happen. We're preparing for the likelihood that it could happen, but that doesn't require us to deploy resources now, because deploying resources too early actually has more of a negative impact. You want to deploy them at the right time, and that's what we're working with NOAA and the state agencies to ensure that we have the plans that get us out in the right places at the right time.
That was Keith Seon, the incident commander for BP at the St. Petersburg Oil Spill Unified Command Center 5 years ago in May of 2010, just a few weeks after the BP Deepwater Horizon blowout. The number here is 813-239-9663, or you can text us at 813-433-0885, or send us an email at dj@wmnf.org if you'd like to talk about the BP oil disaster. In a few minutes, we're going to bring on a professor at the College of Marine Science at USF in St. Petersburg. But right now, we want to take your calls about the BP oil disaster. I have some, obviously, one of the things that when you talk about the BP oil disaster, there was a lot of fines and so forth that that companies had to pay because of this disaster. And some of those fines had gone toward restoration of the landscape. And so I want to play a more recent story, of course, about what are some of the projects that where this money is going. And we'll also talk later with the USF professor about restoration. But here's a story. Why don't you give us a call right now, 813-239-9663, so that I can play your calls after this story. But this is something that our reporter Samuel Johnson did a few months ago, where that at the Madeira Beach City Hall, residents had an opportunity to say how they want the money spent from the $4 million that Florida will receive as part of the Transocean settlement after the 2010 Deepwater Horizon oil disaster. So this is just part of the settlement, because this is just the Transocean part. Eight people showed up for the forum to give their input. And so here's what the story is about what people in Madeira Beach want that money to be spent on.
Congress passed the Restore Act to compensate states around the Gulf of Mexico that were affected by the BP oil disaster. An $800 million Gulf Coast Restoration Trust Fund was set up from the criminal settlement with Transocean. Florida will receive 0.5% of that, or $4 million, for scientific research. It will be administered by the Florida Institute of Oceanography, based in St. Petersburg. FIO's director, Bill Hogarth, says the public will determine what the focus will be.
There are five disciplines that the Restore Act says we need to do one of those five. And we're trying to ask for the public, you know, which of those five they think we should be involved in. We don't want to make that decision. We want the public to give us input as we make that decision. So tonight we will present those, the process we're going to use. We will be giving money to researchers to do this work. And then we want to know which one of the one or more of the five themes that they think we should be involved in.
The devil's in the details. But in general, to qualify for the research money, the proposal needs to be made by Florida residents or companies that focus on Florida's marine issues. Proposals will be vetted by a management team of academics, experts, and professionals. Hogarth stresses the need for baseline data collection.
Last Monday, I was in D.C. talking to BONE, which is the group that, you know, oil and gas regulates, and about why they couldn't require more in the permits for drilling for more of this baseline data. They should be. They should. Yes. How part of the permit should be for baseline data. And they're drilling deeper. You know, Shell's drilling in 2 miles deep water now, 750-foot drilling vessel.
Yeah.
750-foot drilling vessel.
Yeah.
It's going to be deeper. And both of you drill in Florida waters, that make a hill of beans in this. If you have an accident, that deep water, it's going, you're going to get it on Florida beaches.
Peter Quashis, Advocacy Director of Audubon of the West Everglades, is hopeful that long-term impact studies will make their way into the grant proposal submissions.
How do we fill in those gaps in the baselines of what we need? The fact that we don't have good mapping of the Gulf of Mexico, the fact that we don't have any real concept of what quantities of water are necessary for restoration. We've got new players. The fact that we do have oil drilling with risks. We also have sea level rise and, you know, changes of salinity in our estuaries. We have more intense storms than we've seen in the past. Therefore, we end up with greater runoff of our impervious surfaces. So, I mean, a lot of these factors have to be analyzed in order to come up with good science in order to design good projects.
The money has been specifically earmarked for research. $4 million may sound like a lot, but how far can the research grant money be spread? By his own admission, this idea vexes Bill Hogarth. He remains realistic.
That's what's bothering me right now. $4 million doesn't go very far in research. You know, $10,000 a day for a research vessel. Equipment is very expensive. I would be surprised if you do 3-year proposals, you get three done.
This was the first of three hearings throughout the state. The others will be in Naples and Pensacola. Decisions will likely be made in January, but no money will be dispersed until the summer of 2015. Our website, wmnf.org/news, has links to more information, including their public comment survey. For WMNF News, I'm Samuel Johnson on Madeira Beach.
And again, that report was from a few months ago about how Madeira Beach residents want to spend money from the Restore Act to restore their communities and the Gulf of Mexico. The number to call us is 813-239-9663. If you'd like to join this conversation, and you're more likely to get on the air if you call now than if you wait until the end of the show, you can also email us at dj@wmnf.org or text us at 813-433-0885. Our guest is Professor Steve Morawski from the University of South Florida College of Marine Science in St. Petersburg. And Dr. Morawski studies population dynamics and marine ecosystem analysis. He's studying the effects of the BP oil disaster on the health of the Gulf of Mexico. Welcome to Midpoint, Dr. Morawski. Steve Morawski.
Yes, thank you very much for inviting me to participate.
Yeah, thank you for being on the show. What can you tell us about how the Deepwater Horizon disaster has impacted the Gulf?
Well, there's a lot of different impacts. In terms of our understanding of what's happened 5 years out from the spill, it's very clear that a substantial portion of that oil actually still exists in the Gulf. It hasn't necessarily been evaporated or eaten up by the microbes. We know that the impacts are very differential. Some animals and some communities are differentially impacted to a great degree by the oil, and those impacts continue.
So you mentioned that the microbes can be eating up the oil or it's evaporated, but wow, we have a really bad line. You know what? I think what we're going to try to do is call you back on a different line. Is that all right?
Yes, sure. I'd be happy to.
Okay, thanks. If you'd like to join the conversation, 813-239-9663. You can also email us at dj@wmnf.org. And You can send a text to 813-433-0885. Our guest is Professor Steve Murawski from the University of South Florida College of Marine Science. He studies population dynamics and marine ecosystem analysis. He's studying the effects of the BP oil disaster on the health of the Gulf of Mexico, and we'd like to have you call in and ask him questions. He says that a substantial portion of the BP oil still exists, and I believe we have Dr. Murawski back on the line. Are you there? Okay, are you there now?
Yes, I am.
Very good. Thanks so much for being patient with our phone issues. And so what I was going to ask you, you said some of the oil has been evaporated, some has been eaten by microbes, but also the dispersant was used. What role has the dispersant been in controlling the oil spill?
Well, the dispersant, the theory behind dispersants is to make big droplets into very tiny ones, with the hope being that those tiny droplets can be eaten more efficiently by the microbes. What we found is that the addition of both the dispersant at the wellhead and then also at the surface did its job in the sense of helping to create smaller particle sizes. But also, we know that that dispersant and that dispersed oil also joined with sediments coming off of the Mississippi River and dead plankton to form a dense mat of what we call marine snow that has oil droplets in it. And so along the bottom in the deep water of the Gulf of Mexico, we find what we have been calling a dirty blizzard of this impacted dispersant marine snow plankton mix that includes quite a bit of hydrocarbon.
There's been controversy about the dispersant. Should it be used next time if there's a major oil spill? Should there be a dispersant used?
Well, dispersants should be used under certain conditions. And the jury is still out whether or not the use of dispersants at the wellhead a mile down actually produced any more small droplets than would have occurred under normal conditions. And I can tell you that the scientific community and the oil companies are hard at work in trying to understand what the knockoff effect might have been relative to this hot oil exploding out of this well and creating fine droplets. The dispersant at the surface probably was a good idea, especially its use offshore. During the spill, it was not allowed to be used within 30 miles of the coast. And in that sense, it probably hastened the dissolution of the large droplets into small ones. There is a continuing number of studies and debate about whether the added toxicity of the dispersants was harmful to the marine ecosystem. I can tell you that the dispersants themselves are fairly non-toxic. They're more like dish soap than anything else. And then the oil itself is mildly toxic to the animals. But the controversy is whether or not taken in combination, the use of dispersants opens up cell walls that the oil can penetrate and therefore become much more toxic. And that seems to be the center of this debate.
And Steve Murawski is a professor of college at the College of Marine Science at the University of South Florida in St. Petersburg. And he's also director of the Center for Integrated Analysis and Modeling of Gulf Ecosystems. And that's funded by a grant from the Gulf of Mexico Research Initiative. What's the Gulf of Mexico Research Initiative and how is it connected with the disaster funding?
Yeah, that's a very good question. The Gulf of Mexico Research Initiative was created by a grant from BP for $500 million to be spent over 10 years. And what that grant created was an independent group that's chaired by Dr. Rita Colwell, who used to be the head of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And Dr. Colwell and her steering committee basically figure out what their priorities are, and they've made a number of grants to centers like ours over the past 6 years, and they'll be granting for another 4 years after that. The idea being trying to not only get a better handle on what's going on with the BP oil spill, but also in oil spills in general. How should we increase the science to help responders better pick options that are more benign to the environment, and also how can we use environmental data on things like, you know, water movements and the depth of the water and the particular biota to minimize the risks not only of oil spills but also oil spill drilling.
Our guest is Professor Steve Morosky from the University of South Florida College of Marine Science in St. Petersburg. And if you'd like to join this conversation on Midpoint on WMNF, give us a call at 813-239-9663. You can also send us a text to 813-433-0885 or email us at dj@wmnf.org. And Steve Morosky, I'd like to ask you about, you mentioned something about what would happen during future oil spills, and the oil companies now are saying that they can clean up offshore spills far faster today than 5 years ago when the well blew out 45 miles off the coast of Louisiana. This is from an AP story. It says that the CEO of the Marine Well Containment Company, a consortium developing containment technology that was formed after the Deepwater Horizon explosion, he touted technological advances made by the industry since the BP oil spill. Is that true? Would a spill today be contained more quickly from what you know?
Well, the important thing to note is the oil industry was well prepared the day before Deepwater Horizon to respond to a spill that looked a lot like Exxon Valdez. So the next major oil spill may resemble, you know, the Deepwater Horizon, or it may resemble something different. The oil industry is going ever deeper in its quest for oil. Deepwater Horizon was at a mile depth. Last summer, my colleagues and I were out near a Shell drilling rig, and they were drilling in 2 miles of water. And so the question is, are the mechanisms that are being put in place to contain an oil spill at 1 mile going to be as effective if it was at 2 miles? And there are much different conditions that occur at those extreme depths and temperatures than even the Deepwater Horizon. I have no doubt. And actually, this was said many times during the development of the Deepwater Horizon, that many of the devices that were developed during that spill were prototype number one, the first time that anybody had ever built, for example, a containment dome. And I know that the industry has put a lot of money into developing containment domes, et cetera. My fear is that they're all under the premise of a spill like Deepwater Horizon and not something different.
Our guest is Professor Steve Morosky from the University of South Florida College of Marine Science in St. Petersburg. And we're going to go to the phone lines now and take your calls. Jay in Sefner. Jay, you're on the air. What would you like to ask Professor Steve Morosky?
Yeah, I'd like to get a specific answer to the question about the food source of the Gulf of Mexico and the total impact it is having on that food source, the fisheries, et cetera. If you could give that information, I'd appreciate it. I'll take the answer offline. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Jay. And you're talking about food sources for I think Jay dropped off. And I think Jay is talking about food sources for human. And we're also trying to reconnect with Dr. Morosky. So I'm going to go on to the next question and ask the question of the professor in just a second. So we have Jeppin in Northport. Hi, Jeppin.
It's Kevin.
Oh, okay. Kevin, what's your question? Professor Morosky, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, we have a call from Jay, and unfortunately we dropped Kevin off. Kevin, can you call back? Jay was asking about human food sources, so the fisheries. How has the fisheries been impacted by the oil disaster?
Well, I think there's two major aspects to fisheries and people food here. Number one, during this oil spill and hence, the seafood in the Gulf of Mexico is probably among the most tested seafood anywhere on the planet in terms of seafood safety-related issues and potential contamination. And to my knowledge, there have been no reports of any tainted seafood reaching the market, nor anybody reportedly being sick from that. And that's a testament to the inspection both at the state and federal level that's occurred. But so what are the larger issues relative to the seafood supply, and that is the impact on food-related fishes. One thing we know is that the oil spill and its mitigation efforts had a big effect on production of oysters, particularly in coastal Louisiana, where a lot of fresh water was let out of the containment facilities in order to try to flush the oil out to sea. And we know that a lot of the oysters in coastal Louisiana were killed. The oysters have a short life cycle, and in many cases, the oyster production has actually increased back to pre-spill levels. One of the things that we're most interested in is, in the long term, are we seeing population level effects in some of the food fisheries? And one of the things that we've noticed since the oil spill is that the production of baby red snapper has actually declined fairly significantly from the pre-spill levels in what we would call the eastern Gulf of Mexico, and that is from the Mississippi River east to Florida. And whether or not that's associated with the Deepwater Horizon spill or just a downturn from natural causes remains to be seen. But nevertheless, we need to very closely monitor what's going to happen, because when we saw these kinds of phenomena with Exxon Valdez, it took 4 or 5 years to understand that the herring populations in Prince William Sound actually collapsed after the Exxon Valdez spill. We're looking for similar kinds of events relative to the Deepwater Horizon now.
All right, let's go back to the phones, and we're going to take a call. And let's see, caller, you're on the air. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Yes, I was on the line previously holding Eric from Inglewood.
Hi, Eric. What's your question?
I am wondering two different things here. Previously to the or prior to the Gulf spill, almost all other nations on Earth here had outlawed or banned the usage of Corexit A after much research had been done. And now they've slightly changed the formula, and I believe they call it Corexit B, which is still under much speculation. How come we, as a developed nation and supposedly one of the world's superpowers, are continuing to use this toxic poison? And also, second part of the question is, how much funding from Big Oil is supporting the USF grants or research?
Good questions on both of them. Let me take the second one first. In terms of Big Oil, we don't actually get any direct funding from the oil companies themselves. We have a substantial grant that us and our other institutional partners have from the Gulf of Mexico Research Initiative, which was funded by BP, but it's not controlled by BP. So that's considered to be an independent organization with that kind of oversight. In terms of the Corexit issue or the dispersants in general, right now the EPA registers eight chemicals that are allowed to be used as dispersants in U.S. waters. And they've done some toxicity testing for each of those eight compounds. And generally there's no difference between them in terms of the animals they've actually tested. And, you know, we would categorize these as weakly toxic to the types of test animals they use. Now, obviously, as you said, different countries have different standards for the use of this. And really, as in terms of a response methodology, it really is a Hobson's choice. I mean, do you want to add, you know, mildly toxic chemicals to the environment to try to disperse this oil, or do you want to let it, for lack of any other effective response mechanism, let it float into the marshes, where it's virtually impossible to actually clean out of the environment once it's there? And so I don't think anybody likes this choice. Nobody that I talk to likes the potential for putting these kinds of dispersants into the water to try to control, you know, the movement of oil. But on the other hand, there are very few response mechanisms out there that are choices. And so again, you have this situation. What other countries, you know, tend to do, I mean, different countries approach this quite differently. And frankly, the U.S. has probably dealt with more major oil spills than any other country at this point.
Eric, thanks so much for your call. Those were good questions. Our guest is Steve Murawski from the University of South Florida College of Marine Science in St. Petersburg. He studies population dynamics and marine ecosystem analysis, and is studying the effects of the BP oil disaster on the health of the Gulf of Mexico. My name is Sean Cannan. I'm the host on Mondays of Midpoint on WMNF Tampa. And we're going to go back to the phone lines. We have Kevin is back. Kevin, thanks for calling back. What's your question?
My question is, why is Madeira Beach, why are they being asked what the money should be spent on? I didn't believe they were actually affected by the spill. Wouldn't it be better to go to the people of Panama City and Pensacola and Fort Walton Beach, places that did get oil wash up on the shores?
Yeah, that's a great question. The money that Sean was talking about before in the radio piece was money that was allocated to the Florida Institute of Oceanography, which is a consortium of about 20 different universities and private research institutions in Florida. And I think what's happening is they are conducting a series of public hearings, the most southern being Madeira Beach, but the other ones being up at the University of West Florida in Pensacola and elsewhere along the Gulf Coast so that they can gather a wide range of input. I'm not positive about that, but I do believe that's the strategy as far as that goes. Now, in terms of why Madeira Beach, Madeira Beach is one of the major fishing ports on the Gulf of Mexico, and obviously fishers in Florida and in Madeira Beach, that's an important subgroup. And, in fact, one of the major priorities that the Florida Institute of Oceanography has instituted in terms of spending this money is downstream impacts on fish and fisheries. And so I think gathering information from fishers that either are directly or indirectly affected, and certainly the fishers in Madeira Beach were indirectly affected by the oil spill, is a priority.
Thank you for the answer. Have a good day.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for that call, Kevin, and we appreciate that call. And let's see who's been holding the longest. Guy in Tampa, you're on the air. What would you like to ask our guest?
Yes, good afternoon. I have some concerns about the Gulf Stream and the impact of all this oil on the Gulf Stream and what that would mean for life in the ocean and the weather pattern and how much that would change life for everybody if the Gulf Stream just stopped flowing because of all of this.
So that's a really good question. And, you know, the whole issue of the Gulf Stream and how it flows and you know, how it interacts with all of this was certainly something that we confronted 5 years ago in response to the oil spill. I don't know if you recall, but at the time there was great fear here and elsewhere in Florida and even up the Atlantic seaboard that the Deepwater Horizon oil would get entrained in the Gulf Stream or in something we call the loop current, which is the beginnings of the Gulf Stream, and then, you know, shoot up the East Coast. And in fact, there was projections that, you know, it would end up halfway to Ireland. And in the circumstances that happened, there was a blocking current that was established that didn't allow this oil to actually get to the Atlantic side, which, you know, certainly in terms of the Atlantic and southern part of Florida was a good thing. In terms of the oil impact on the currents itself, obviously oil is much lighter than water. In most cases, the oil would be some kind of surface phenomenon. You could actually project that if you had enough oil at the surface, that it might change the way that winds interact with the water. You know, what happens is the wind energy is transferred to the water currents by the small wavelets that it brings up. But if you have oil on the surface, it actually breaks up those little wavelets and you don't get as much friction transfer of that energy. And so it's quite – and in fact, you know, during a marine disaster like a shipwreck, sometimes in the past people would actually put oil on the water around the shipwreck, which would tend to break up some of these what we call capillary waves. Whether or not an oil spill could be large enough to impact such a massive current like the Gulf Stream, I doubt it. But you know, anything's possible in this day and age.
Thank you for that. Thank you, Guy. Thanks so much for that call. I appreciate it. We're going to go back to the phones in just a second, but I have an email question for our guest. Our guest is Steve Morosky from the University of South Florida College of Marine Science, and we're talking about the BP oil disaster and the 5 years since and the effects it's had on the Gulf of Mexico. It's 12:49 in the afternoon, and my name is Sean Canaan. 813-239-9663 is the number to call if you'd like to get in on this conversation. We had a caller who wanted to know about mercury and other heavy metals. That's the first question. We also have an email that says, hasn't there been a higher amount of deaths of dolphins due to the oil spill? And that comes from Suzanne. So do you have answers to those two questions?
Yeah, both are really good questions and you know, really relevant to what we're talking about. A number of years ago, and in fact, in the early 1990s, there was a concern that, you know, since heavy metals are a constituent of crude oil, that the, you know, spilling of large amounts of crude oil might increase the amount of mercury and other, you know, cadmium and other heavy metals in the environment. And, you know, since the oil spill, there's actually been quite a bit of work on heavy metals. Some of the universities in northern Florida have been doing some work on this. And so far, there hasn't been a large quantity of mercury and other over the above and above the ambient level that seems to either be in the environment or working its way through the different biota that are in the environment as a result of the oil spill. But nevertheless, you know, since it is a constituent, you know, it's something that really merits us looking at. And this is particularly an issue with you talk about burning of the oil, you know, because burning of the oil and of course, you know, all kinds of industrial burning will release mercury into the atmosphere where it becomes more available for people. And it also becomes distributed over a much wider area. So certainly this is something that we need to keep looking at. And the second question that you had was on the impacts on dolphins. And in the past couple of months, NOAA has released a report on the health effects on the bottlenose dolphin population, particularly in the area around coastal Louisiana, which was heavily impacted by oil coming ashore. And what they've done is compared the health status of dolphin populations in coastal Louisiana to dolphin populations down here in Florida, and found that the immune systems of those animals up north are much more compromised than the immune systems down here off Florida, which is attributed to the Deepwater Horizon effect. There was also something called an unusual mortality event that has occurred that was ongoing even prior to the oil spill, and resulted in a number of baby dolphins and spontaneously aborted fetuses coming ashore. And, you know, while you can't say with certainty that that's a Deepwater Horizon impact, certainly that would be consistent with the compromised health status of the bottlenose dolphin populations.
So thank you for that email and that call. Also, this is a related text message that we just got in. Someone from the 917 area code is asking, what about reports of cancers and mutations in Gulf shrimp and seafood from dispersants?
I haven't seen any definitive studies that indicate that that the dispersant use themselves have resulted in any increase in cancers in either shrimp or other seafood. I have seen deformities in shrimp and other seafood, you know, particularly in the area around Grand Isle, Louisiana. The real question there is, are these just normal abnormalities that you see in large populations every once in a while, or has the incidence of these increased? And I've seen no scientific studies that have published on that have demonstrated that with any certainty.
Our guest is Professor Steve Murawski from the University of South Florida College of Marine Science in St. Petersburg. It's 12:53 in the afternoon, and we have about 7 minutes left on the Midpoint Show. And if you'd like to call in, you can give us a call at 813-239-9663. You can send us a text to 813-433-0885 or email us at dj@wmnf.org. We're going to go back to the phones now. William in Sarasota, you're on the air.
Hi. My question has been changing ever since I've been listening through the time to get online. Actually, what I want to ask is the impact on the ecosystem. And I did want to direct the question more upon, we rely upon small microorganisms. Basically, Florida has been built on very small microorganisms over a period of maybe billions of years, or even I don't exactly want to try and estimate. But I want to know, when we impact with our development of growth upon the landscape of Florida itself, changing the ecosystem, such as the estuaries that are very important to not only mammal life, but human and other species of animals that exist around Florida, which is a very, we are very eco-sensitive area. If we are to look at it in the world situation, we are probably one of the leading. Australia and other places may be accounted to as well. But when we look at these things, and we actually have been changing the interior landscape by lowering the water because of our huge consumption, also the way we actually build on the available landscape, we are actually lowering the level of the water.
William, that's a lot to answer right now. Let's see what our guest has to say about that.
Well, I certainly agree with the premise of the caller that humans can have an enormous footprint on the ecosystems of estuarine areas and the coastal ocean around Florida, and have had since probably time immemorial. You know, we know that in the industrial age now that many of the natural and more importantly synthetic chemicals can have major impacts on ecosystems. They disrupt the reproductive cycles of animals. Many of the compounds we're talking about, including crude oil, are compounds that mimic estrogen in the waters, and so they result in the feminization of males and other issues that can have long-term repercussions in terms of ecosystems. As far as the oil spill itself, we have seen major ecological change in the areas that are easily observed, and we will likely see major ecological change that persists for decades just because so much of that oil remains in the environment, both in the shallow water environment, in the estuaries, and in the deep sea, where somewhere between 4 and 10% of that oil still exists. One of the real challenges for the Gulf of Mexico is it's an area that we would call a working waterfront. Currently, about 500 million barrels of oil per year are taken from the Gulf of Mexico. It's a major fishing area. It's a transportation hub, et cetera. And with all these human activities, there's a cumulative effect in terms of the impacts on the environment, and that's really the kinds of things that we need to understand if we're to avoid what we would call tipping points, and that is places where and times where the ecosystem pretty much gives up, because it can't accommodate so much human activity.
Thanks for that question, William, and we're going to go and see if we have time for one quick question. Lef in Brooksville, do you have a quick question for our guest?
No, not really. I think Dr. Steve just answered my question. I'm a USF chemistry alum, and I know that oil floats on the water, and I wanted to know, given the deep pressure of the drilling operation, if there was a reasonable assumption that all the oil had dispersed, and he just said that 10% or so is still down there. And my real concern was, I know that over time the oil will disperse. And if you go to a marina, you'll see a sheen around boats where fuel is off water. And apparently, I guess over time, that's what's going to happen to all this oil. It's going to be dispersed and not be in the solution. And I hope I'm correct in that. And how long do we think this particular oil is going to be at that depth?
Les, thank you for that call. Let's see if Steve Morosky can answer the question in a few seconds.
That's a great question, and in terms of the answer, we have been studying not only the Deepwater Horizon spill, but a spill that occurred off of Mexico 35 years ago in 1979, 1980, and that spill, the residual for that, still exists on the bottom some 35 years later, and so we think that some of this oil will remain in recognizable form for decades to come.
All right. Thanks so much for joining us on WMF's Midpoint today, Steve.
Yeah, you're most welcome.
Thank you. Steve Morosky is a professor at the University of South Florida College of Marine Science in St. Petersburg. He studies population dynamics and marine ecosystem analysis and the effects of the BP oil disaster. Thanks to everyone who called, emailed, and texted today. If you'd like to leave a voicemail with your thoughts, call me at 813-238-8001 and leave a message on extension 114. I'll play your message. You can also join the conversation online at WMNF.org/news or on Facebook or Twitter at WMNF News. Stay tuned now for hours and hours of great music, beginning with Fleas. It's the Music Show on WMNF Tampa.
You're listening to 88.5 WMNF Tampa.
This beat that the devil today has nurtured and fostered is inspired by the powers of hell. And there are young people that are in these rock groups that are pulling off their clothes in full view of thousands of young people.